For those of you who don't know, I'm Elmer Witt, and serving as village philosopher and leading, hopefully, a discussion about Bill Deal's book, Christianity in Real Life. How many of you have had a chance to see the book or look at it or anything? I see that, is it Paul? You have? Anyone else? You have?
We use it.
Oh, you use it, so you know it. Well, then you can... All right, great. And you've had it, and did you say you do it too? All right, that's neat. Well, let's, if it's agreeable with you, I think that we can break it into the first four chapters today, hopefully, and maybe four tomorrow, and that's 40 pages, 45 pages, and then there's sort of a wrap-up, much of which, in that last section, I think is covered in the first eight. So that'll give us some feeling of moving through the book a bit, and then leave some time for some good discussion, I would hope, each day. If you didn't have a chance to look at it today, and for those of you who don't have the copy, I'll try to summarize what I understand to be in those first four chapters, and then open it up for discussion. I think a book discussion group ought to be discussion. That's one of the ideas. And if you haven't read the book, the goal is to try to get you to take a look at it, and maybe, as you say, find out your way to use it in discussion, too. For those of you who don't know, Bill Deal is a member of the Lutheran Church in America, a lay person, very active in his church body, is presently, I think, still a member of the Executive Council of the Lutheran Church in America, at least wasn't recently. He writes in the Lutheran, the national publication of the Lutheran Church in America, a very active member of the church. The story that he tells in here revolves around what he calls at the outset two gaps. The first gap, to quote him, is the one which is present in my life and in the lives of thousands of dedicated Christian lay people. It is the gap between our Sunday faith and our weekday world, about what we say and teach, preach, and sing about on Sunday and what happens in the rest of the life that we live out during the week. That's number one. Number two, the second gap is the one which is present in the life of the institutional church. It's the gap, the one is present in him, the other isn't present in the institutional church. The gap between what the church proclaims as the role of Christian laypersons in the world and what the church actually does to support that role. So what it announces, suggests, maybe even writes up as being the role of the layperson in the world is grossly different from what it actually causes to happen and supports happening. That's the second gap that Bill Deal is writing about. Okay. In his first chapter, called Something is Missing, he reviews the life of Eli Black, Nancy Smith, Julie, I don't know if her second name is given, and Chris Waynes. And they are four lay people, the people that he was acquainted with. Eli Black was a, for those of you who did look at that section, a Jewish rabbinically trained president of United Fruit who committed suicide. And, you know, people just said that's it, except that somebody on the Wall Street Journal went behind the scenes and found out what happened in his life. And he tells the story of how Mr. Black really was committed to doing something about his religious commitments inside of the United Fruit industry. And then talks about what happened when United Brands was picked up and all the things that happened so that apparently Eli Black could not do in his life what he wanted to do. And that it was really his suicide was an act of desperation in trying to bring about some continuity between what he believed and what was happening in the life as he was in operation of that huge corporation or multinational corporation. Second story, that about Nancy, Nancy Smith, who became very active in the causes of poor in the city, became concerned. Took on the local prison system, became a spokesman for it, headed a study about it, and when the reports came out, she was branded as a troublemaker and got support from her own family, but the members of the community, and especially then also the members of her church, were against her for what she had done. And particularly she, when she sought support, didn't receive it, and finally dropped out of the church, and her line was, "Anne," sighs Nancy with a wistful smile, "nobody really cared that we left." The third was the story of Julie, where Bill Deal is leading a discussion about future shock, getting ready for some of the things coming down the pike with a bunch of young people at a retreat, I think a dozen of them or something like that, 13 to 14 to 16 years old, and as they're probing into the future shock and all the stuff that they're dealing with there, world hunger, war threats in the Middle East, energy shortage, inflation, scandal in government, pollution, rising crime rates, increased drug usage and all this, it became apparent to him as he worked for a period of time with these young people that Julie was the one that had sort of caused this discussion to take place. And as he tried to get behind all of this, he found out that Julie came from a very pretty secure family where some hope about the Christian life in the world was being espoused, and good support from her family. And then he says, "Well, why don't you do this in other places? For instance, why don't you raise these kind of things in Sunday school?" And her line was, when I encouraged her to do so, she said, "Well, we really don't have the time for that kind of thing in Sunday school." Her concern was the young people who had given up on solving any of these problems. Everything was so tremendously big, difficult, they couldn't possibly participate in it. So they were giving up on the society. Julie wanted to do something about that for them. And Bill Deal says, and she got no support from her congregation to be about that kind of thing because it didn't fit the pattern. Chris Wayne, briefly as a physician, gets increasingly concerned about how there are at least two levels of medical care being delivered, how when someone who is white comes in, they get certain kind of care. If you're black, you get another kind of care. Usually the intern puts a Band-Aid on and doesn't care. He makes a commitment to stay into the outpatient clinic area, working with the poor, gives up a good deal of his income, good deal of the future, the possibility of the future of his family in order to stay in it. Bill Deal says if he had done this in Africa, the church would have supported him. He did it in his town, and he had to hack it himself. It wasn't seen as part of the church's mission to do it locally. And the last time he saw him, he said how he did it and how exciting and exhausting his ministry became a story in itself. He's still struggling to make ends meet financially, but all of his children have been able to go to college, and all of them have chosen medicine as their field. And that's a story about these people. Something's missing, he says. Here are people who have commitment and wanting to do something out there, and there aren't the roots of support from the institutional church. The second chapter is largely about an idea that has been around at least since the, probably since the New Testament time, but largely raised again in the 50s. This is when I came in contact with a whole different for me understanding of the mission of the church. Let me go back lovingly and lively to the 1950s, when much of the literature on a gathered and scattered church began. A fellow like Hockendyke and Rudy Weber and Kramer and a number of other people that are mentioned here, who said the idea is to gather the church together so it is nourished and strengthened and supported and cleansed, if you will, and then to send it out. And his contention in this chapter is largely we've been really great at the gathering, we really have been very poor at the scattering, and that there is really no sense of being sent out, and that we stay focused in our gatheredness so that we don't get at living that out in the world around us, or we see the gatheredness as the ultimate thing. If there are more people gathered, then that must be the mark of success of the church, rather than more people gathered in order to be scattered, where he contends out of this chapter, that's where we really belong, living it out in the context of the world in which we exist. He makes a pretty good case in defense, I think, of parish pastors, because it sounds here, you know, this is like a diatribe against the local church and the parish pastor. He says, I'd probably be doing the same kind of thing if I were the one, because they are taught largely to hang on to what's there, and if it's gone, people say, well, then you don't have anything to keep the thing moving, and all of the evaluators of his ministry are in terms of the size and development and growth of that gathered group. You don't get brownie points for what happens out there in the world because nobody's keeping records. And so if you have a dwindling congregation, or if your congregation takes on, by scattering people, gets into some trouble for whatever reason, you aren't going to get any points out of that. And so the very normal, according to Deal, thing would be to close it in and focus on the gathered church. And the former parish, former pastor that I had, in the, since I'm not a parish pastor presently, I was, I think in the, I'm guessing, seven or eight years that I heard him preach, I don't think there was one illustration of service to the Lord outside of service to a committee or board or function of the congregation. I don't think there was one. In other words, whatever you did for the Lord was being a good member of the stewardship committee, being a member, all which Deal is saying, you know, and that's not out, but if that's all that it's about, obviously it's focused in on itself. And that's not the gathering and the scattering that he's talking about, the rhythm of the Christian life. Okay? And then I'll jump to the third and talk about that. And if you want, you know, dig more questions, maybe we can go back and read some sections if you like, too. He talks about Christianity in real life and uses a fellow by the name of Ernest to, as his jump-off point. Ernest was the custodian of a large church in Baltimore. He took early retirement from his job at another big steel company because he got so discouraged trying to supervise people who neither wanted to work nor cared about the quality of their products. Once you talk to Ernest and hear his philosophy of life, you realize that here's a man who is genuine. He comes across honest, hard-working man who values quality as the fruits of his labor. But he was so upset and so discouraged, he decided to look around for another job and take early retirement, and he ended up working at First Lutheran Church in Baltimore. And then he was making a choice between Christianity and real life, and he threw himself in with Christianity, meaning the church, where he could be about the quality of what he wanted to do and have people that he thought agreed with him. But he set up that that contrast of Christianity and real life. And Deal, of course, has very strong disagreements with making that distinction. He asks about how could the church have helped him, and he then illustrates ways that people have been doing that today. Getting support groups for them, two people going out at a time. Jesus indicated that clearly indicated the church dealt seriously with the ministry of all believers, as St. Paul did. Paul's treatment of the lay ministry offers basic points that are absolutely essential for a responsible ministry of lay people, and it deals with gifts and recognize the variety of gifts that people have. Not everybody can do the same kinds of things. And he points out illustrations from that from Paul in Ephesians. And then quotes from Elizabeth O'Connor, and again from Martin Luther, where I think that's a section that's often quoted, where he urges upon laity and clergy alike to become little Christs in society. In the same manner as Jesus ministered to human beings, so Luther saw all the believers having a universal ministry to others. In one of his better known examples, Luther says, "If you are a craftsman, you will find the Bible placed in your workshop, in your hands, in your heart. It teaches and preaches how you ought to treat your neighbor. Only look at your tools, your needle, your thimble, your beer barrel, your articles of trade, your scales, your measures, and you will find this saying written on them. You will not be able to look anywhere where it does not strike your eyes. None of these things with which you deal daily are too trifling to tell you this incessantly if you are but willing to hear it. There is no lack of such preaching for you, for you have as many preachers as there are transactions, commodities, tools, and other implements in your house and your estate. And they shout this to your face, 'My dear sir, use me toward your neighbor as you would want him to act toward you with that which is his.'" And that's the ministry that he really espouses. So the focus again on that real life being the same as where Christianity is being lived, rather than separated or apart. Strong chapter on that. And last, roles and resources, the fourth chapter. He's trying to figure out why we why it's so tough to make any changes about this switch. He thinks that there are really two kinds of lay people. Type A, who have their interests in the world outside the church. These laity are active in their careers in local or national politics, in various voluntary civic organizations, and their homes and their family lives. And laity type B have their main interest in life centered on their church and their organization. They serve on committees, teach Sunday school, singing choirs, raise funds, call on all new members. It's the type B who are usually the lay leadership positions of the local congregation and regional conference districts and national boards. It is the layperson who has faithfully served his congregation who is nominated to go to the conventions. Loyal service on regional committee goes up the ladder for national boards, and that's where it goes, and he traces his own story in the same way. When he got to the Executive Council of the LCA, I think he found on a board of 30 members, three lay people in the sense that he was talking about type A. All the others were assistants and everybody else, and so the focus of the national kind of leadership was clergy and type B, and he wasn't putting them down. You know, I hope you understand. He isn't saying that shouldn't happen, but if that's all that happens, he's saying, what can you expect from the church and its leadership towards a ministry out in the world if the focus of all the people who are in leadership is on ministry exclusively inside of the institution itself? And he says, these people are the ones who keep going out to tell other lay people to get more active in their church, meaning in the congregation, rather than acknowledging, recognizing, helping them discover, perhaps, what their ministry is already out in the world. And then he talks about how the resources of the church are used, how they're put together, where they put emphasis on them, in the helps that are given, in training, support groups, money spent, sermons given, and again he thinks it's all skewed in that one direction. He has, a classic illustration about a sermon he heard that the fellow had a good biblical basis and rationale for an oral communication of faith. He was good, very good. Having developed a strong case on the basis of our theology, he turned to the real-life practical application. Looking out across the congregation with great passion, he threw out this challenge: next time someone asks you why you are a Christian, what will you say? My heart sank. I sighed in key disappointment. That was not the right question. In all the years of work and travel in my career as a businessman, and all those conferences, all those business meals, all those plane trips, not once did anyone ever ask me why I was a Christian. Associates of mine who were aware of some of the things I was doing in our lives may have asked why we were doing them. The real question, he goes on later on, is how does a layperson initiate a discussion relating to his faith without immediately turning off the other person? A whole different question as far as Deal was concerned, and how this guy who was good biblically had missed this because he wasn't able to make that jump. He feels very strongly that the contemporary mode of sharing the gospel among ourselves in the institutional church doesn't do it. We have said if we preach the gospel clearly enough, people will be able to translate it out there. Deal says, wrong. Doesn't work. Impossible. If we have good clergy who would understand, Deal says, not possible. Clergy don't understand. His real strong message is that it has to be developed and shaped by the lay people themselves with the help and support of the clergy for their own formation of ways to share. And if you will, as we'll talk about later on, he has a very strong feeling, therefore, support groups made up of lay leadership in addition to congregational life is one of the key approaches that he thinks might work in helping. He doesn't end the book, as you might guess, saying, well, now there's a few easy things to do. He thinks this is a terribly deep and lasting struggle, and there might be some things we might begin to do. I don't know if that's helpful or confusing, but that's a bit of an overview of the first four. Does it lead you to any meanderings or musings or questions or comments, observations?
He's right.
Well, just like, you know, my husband and I, we have a raspberry farm, you know,
mm-hmm.
and during the harvest it's just really hectic, you know, And we find that in our church, no one really understands the demand that we're in. And they say, well, why weren't you at Bible study prayer meeting? Yes, well, we were so tired, you know. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, well, you know, it says the Lord is our strength. And if you'd have came, you'd have been, you know, had strength. They, you know, him and I were talking now. How do you explain to them? Because they wouldn't understand, you know. Because you're supposed to be there every Sunday and every Wednesday and every Thursday morning. And, you know, that's a good Christian. But, you know, never stop you to realize that we were in a busy, at a very busy time. And we got no understanding from...
Someone respond? I would hope we'd all would. I mean, otherwise, I feel I have to each time.
I don't think she should feel guilty.
Oh, we don't feel guilty about, you know, not being able to go, but it is, you know, you stop and think that, you know, they are the people you expect to understand, but they, you know, they don't. That, you know, they, you know, going to church is the ultimate support in churches. You know, being at Bible study, that kind of, which is all good, you know, faithfulness is good. But, you know, like I said, during the summer, that's a real hard time for us, you know.
It's that gathering bit again, huh?
Yeah.
No.
That their ministry would be to be the best raspberry farm owners and administrators and workers in the area. I mean, that's what they would be about, and that's a ministry that is not separate from their Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And the opportunity for ministering to the workers and the pickers and everything else is far greater than the Bible study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they don't understand that, you know. Mm-hmm. They have no comprehension. You can't, you know, they sit down and try to explain, oh, you know what the Lord did today, you know? And how it ministered to all our pickers. Lauren's the raspberry girl. So he knows that we're talking about. But I mean, you know, how the Lord ministers, you know. But it's hard to explain, you know, how
the difference between a type A and type B member in the congregation.
Yeah.
Like you have a lot of type B people in your church.
Uh-huh.
At least during the summer, you really identify yourself more as a type A person out there.
Uh-huh.
And it's difficult to communicate to those two groups.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
You know, scriptures tell us that out of the mouths of babes and sucklings. About a year ago, I had a new family move into our church. This little boy was pretty sharp, and he was in a room of junior church while the service was going on. And when the service was over, the children always liked to come and meet me at the door because they're just as important as anybody else. I was shaking hands with him, and his mother was standing there, and he looked in the nave, and he said, "What happened to the church?" And the mother was about to say, "Why, honey, it's still there." I said, "It went out to work." And he said, "When will we be back?" I said, "Next Sunday."
Mm.
You know, that got around the congregation.
That's neat. That's neat.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. Yeah.
It sounds like this person's Bill's philosophy is very similar to Jockey Liu in his book, Presence of
the Kingdom,
where he really stresses that truly the lay person who's in the world and understands the struggle and tension in the world, that it's the person that can best speak to the concerns, and almost the clergy, because so much of our function focuses around the gathered community, really have a hard time really understanding and working with that scattered community, but it's really the lay person.
How can that be changed?
That change in terms of what?
How can that be changed?
How can that be changed?
You mean the clergy?
No.
Focusing primarily on the...
Well,
no, how can there be change?
Right.
That is right. Generally.
Go ahead.
Oh, I don't know. I've been with a lot of people who've been struggling with this, first trying to do it on the adult level. Tried to go to grant for the Lee Foundation and tried to and got started, although we funded first a center for Christian ministry together with several seminaries. And I was my part in it was to write into it a bunch of skills courses for lay people, where in groups they'd work on with a lot of the things that he talked about, witnessing, working with people who are disabled in the hospitals and stuff. And at first the departments in the seminaries weren't too interested in it, but then they got real interested in it. The trouble is, it's all right now theology courses. It's never gotten back to the thing that was originally intended, the equipping. And so after a few years in that area, I really feel that the two things that will change it is you've got to work this out in the church school education in terms of from about 6 years old and up, emphasizing the doing of things naturally out in the school. I mean, if it comes naturally, like a kid can talk naturally and can talk about things, I think that if they can start doing other things naturally and see it relating into their world, I think they're in much better shape. Right now, most kids, at least when I went to Sunday school, it was what we do in Sunday school is there, what we do out in the world on the playground, what we do when we watch TV or something is totally different.
And it hasn't changed.
But yeah, it hasn't changed too much. With some of us trying to change it. The other thing is that kids, and this happens not only in the church, but also, I mean, not only with sermons, but also in Sunday school, we teach Bible stories. I'm not against teaching Bible stories, but and Deal mentions this. I mean, we should be doing things inductively. There's a problem, and we should be bringing some. We should bring a Bible story or something to it about how to solve that real problem. But both the sermon and the Sunday school turns it around and does it deductively, which says, hey, here's the theology or here's this Bible story. And by the way, you know, it can solve this particular problem. And you have to think up a few. When all these kids have real problems that are, you know, hitting them. And the surprising thing is that, I don't know how we got doing this. Well, I think we must have adapted the church school education, the education out in the real world. We must have copied it because seems to me most of the time Jesus was inductive. He met people with their problems and he told a story. Now we've taken those stories and we tell them as though they have some magical meaning apart from some kind of a context. So what we're trying to do now is, have been doing for 2 years, is to get skill building throughout the church school where kids to each other are relating in terms of prayer, witnessing, that's another thing, because kids always learn from Sunday school. You always talk about Christianity to adults. You never talk of Christianity to another kid, you know, because you're asked to be quiet. Or, I mean, it's always the adult-child interaction. So, I mean, myself and several of us in the Evanston area think that you've got to start down there. If you wait until people are adults, we feel it. They say you're uncomfortable. Well, I'm uncomfortable with my talking to somebody. As though somehow magically, once they're a Christian, they're going to be able to witness. It's like not talking at all for 16 years and all of a sudden trying to speak English fluently.
But is that a cop-out? I guess I'm not so pleased about running to the children. Let me say my point on it and then, you know, a discussion. I think the church is just lousy at adult education. And we say it won't work because we are lousy at adult education. I don't buy that cop-out. We don't know how to do adult education. We haven't done adult education yet. I don't think we do it here in Holden. And so I think that, you know, I think it works with adults. And that doesn't mean don't do it with the children at all. But I just won't buy saying that people who have learned something 16 years in Poland can come over here and slam, bang, have English in 3.5 weeks. People move them and go into the industry in 6-month courses and zoom. The human potential is fantastic if we would learn how to do it. I want to label our inability to work with adults as part of the reason. And I just don't, I don't want to let the church off of that hook.
One thing that we're doing in our congregation, first of all, we use this this book as a text for adult study.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly I agree with the need to work with the children or also be working with them. But we found that one of the things that really needed to happen was kind of a sensitizing process, I'll say. So one couple things we did that you might think about trying is we put out in the narthex a big map of Greater Los Angeles. And we had everybody in the congregation identify in some color codes where they live, where they work, where they go to church, where they spend their leisure time. And one of the impacts of this was that we saw that in our small congregation of about 300 people, we are spread completely all over that map, so that there's no denying, because it's right there to see, that we have opportunities to minister during the week throughout and beyond that huge metropolitan area. Then we went through a process of having everyone who was willing to do so, and we were amazed that out of 300, we within 2 weeks had 90 responses for people to tell us, what is your ministry during the week? What is your, in other words, what is your job? Whether you're a housewife or you're a professional woman or man or a student of any age, whatever you do during the week, that's where you are living out your Christian life. And we gave them a little bit of guide to follow. And then the Social Concerns Committee published that. And every week, every Sunday, two people are held up in the prayers of the people for their ministry during the week by name. And so, but that's only, we feel that's like sort of the first to falter in step, because we laity have also been programmed through the years by the way we've been trained from childhood, as well as our pastors, to think in terms of the pastor's pretty much responsible for giving the guidance of what goes on in the church. I just want to tell one other anecdote quickly. Five years ago, I was the kind of church person who sang in the choir and did some of the pretty work. I don't even remember, but I do know that on the same day that I received at the university I was working in there, noticed that I'd been the recipient of a fairly large federal grant to run a program amounting close to $1 million. That I got a call from my church asking me to bake cookies for the fundraising committee. And that's part of Deal's point, too,
yeah.
That we don't know enough about each other to know where our skills are. And let me tell you, my skills are definitely not in baking cookies, although my daughters do it quite well and they bake the cookies for the fundraising committee. But his is a double point. Not only do we not do well with the type B A Christian, we don't do too well with the type B Christians either.
Yeah, good point.
Why is it that it's the type B that often, I believe I got the two types right there, you're 17% that, carry the church, basically, both financially and skillfully and whatever. And why is that? Why do we have type A, type B, and why isn't type A allowed to carry the church? And I think you hinted on your talk, what he was talking about, the way we've gone about it is wrong, or it doesn't work.
You count the type B's as being all that help direct a dissertation for a pastor who studied the congregation. And what we did is looked at people from the 45 to the 55 age of several large congregations. And those type B's burn out. And, started to check on those people that are leaving. And we identified some of the reasons that they're burning out. And for me, I think the type A, type B thing is much, obviously, too simple. And because I think that people who are activists outside are also activists within their church. But what happens is, when they're activists within their church, they all of a sudden see some conditions in the church that blow them out quicker, because they're pretty energizing kinds of people. And some of the things is, we identified four or five things that have a tendency to make things not work in the church, and we've tried to change them in our adult program. I mean, operationally defining being a Christian is doing committee work,
people are asked to fill a position and not to problem solve. And this really can burn people out. In other words, instead of doing, you fill these deacons or that and get a whole bunch of problems, not calling people to do a certain job. And then when it's over, it's finished, and you're rewarded for it, rather than a three-year or one-year stint.
Sort of task force.
Right. So our church has tried now to go toward a, where we call people out for a certain period of time to take care of certain problems. And then they feel that when that's through, then they can go on to something else, rather than being locked in for a year or 2 years. And one of the other things is that people get easily discouraged when, for instance, half the people on the committee don't show up, or they get poor results. And we have felt that's because the people on the committee don't know each other. And so what we tried to do was get the people to look at themselves, both spiritually and emotionally. And then, you know, and that way, when there is discouragement, they can support each other. So I don't know. Mm-hmm.
It's too good news. Let me tell you a story about Evanston. I did a study of 29 congregations over a period of 2.5 years for one of the judicatories of our church body, in which all lay people except myself had been set out to find a congregation that was taking their laity seriously. And as you might guess, in the 2.5 years we found none and reported that, said report having not been printed as promised, but I can get you a copy if you're interested. And a pastor from Evanston, whose name shall remain, a neat fellow, good friend of mine and everything else, told me about, so you might even know this person, this is dangerous to tell this, but it's favorable to the person to talk to me. This pastor told me, you ought to talk to so-and-so. He's sort of interested in, you know, lay ministry. And I, well, why? And he said, he mentioned it to me, or whatever it was. And this is some years ago, so I'm pulling on memory. And I said, well, what's he do? And he said, I don't know, he works for a printer downtown. And I said, well, you know, give me his name, give his number. And I called him, and I went down and had lunch with the guy. The guy had just finished editing the series of books for readers in primary grades that are used across the country. What the heck's the publisher? It's on Ontario Street downtown in Chicago. He had been the primary editor of the whole doggone series, shaping over a period of time the stories used, everything else that was done in those books to be used in literally thousands of public schools all over America. And this good guy, not a lazy duff, a great fellow. You'd love him. He'd go great guns at Holding. This guy said, I don't know, he works at some printer downtown. Yowie! What a ministry! To be, if nothing else, to just say to the guy, how's it going, or something, you know. The guy wouldn't let me go. We went to 3 that afternoon, telling me stories. He rode the L, and he rode buses to find stories to put in those books. And what an exciting kind of thing. I can still get tingly thinking about the thing that happened. Well, I mean, that illustrates. How do you get to do it? We don't know. He didn't know. In all of those 29 congregations, each pastor started out telling me, sure, I know my people. Sure. It took an average of 18 hours. I was with lay people and with pastors. Took up an average of 18 hours with the pastor before he started getting honest. And he didn't know his people. The results of that survey were that the pastor did not know his people, other than those he had been in immediate, in dire crisis situations. The lay people knew the pastor didn't know his people and liked it.
I think we have to be really careful, because this is mm-hmm. almost a movement,
mm-hmm.
and it's not limited to the Lutheran Church.
Indeed.
By any means. But again, we mustn't say that the pastors, or for that matter, the institutional
mm-hmm.
church, all the way to Minneapolis or St. Louis or wherever, is the one that's got to make this happen.
Mm-mm.
Because that's the same old
exactly.
thing. But your question is very important. How, what can bring the change? Well, it since it's the laity, right here we're talking about enabling, then I say the laity have to bring the change.
I do too. I say openness for anybody, on the part of anybody, lay people and clergy, for the laity to bring it about. And I don't know, that's still to say how. How are we going to cause those people to be open to let it happen? Because as Dio points out in his book, you know, he can hit them off the pass.
Yeah, you don't have to change structure, partially.
I think the laity will cause that, yeah.
You were talking about the pastor doesn't know his people. Mm. How can a pastor know 500 people or 1,000 people or meet in Minneapolis and 1,200, 1,500 people? That says a lot about your structure.
Sure, but I offered the pastors a chance to meet one.
Yeah.
As a project. 29 people were invited to meet a member of their congregation with no agenda. 19 agreed to do it. Most of the 19 identified the person they would meet. All male, by the way. I never said man. I just said a member, and they all chose a man. Not one of the 19 did it. My committee wouldn't believe it. And you guessed it right away. They were afraid. So you're saying.
Well, I think that's why, as much as we try to change adult education, it's very serious. If people are... Even when we did the change, it was the same 40 or 50 people that went to these classes, you know what I mean? And the other 1,800 in this congregation were not affected. And when it comes to adult ed, and when instead of being a Bible study, we were trying to talk about offering opportunities for people to get into visitation. And we'd have nurses there who were members of the congregation who would talk about different things, you know. By the second or third week, it was down to the old handful. And so I feel that people are socialized into expecting certain things, and when you're talking about people in their 30s and 40s, you're right, I don't know how it's done, and a lot, I mean, I don't know if any, how do you change those really built-in expectations?
I see, I don't start with the congregation, and if you do, and you know, that's fine, and I think some ought, and therefore I'd start with the kids. But you're going to have to start with adults to teach the kids, you know, somebody's going to. So you're really starting with adults anyway. But if you're talking about inside the congregation, I'm talking about freeing the people to do it. And if they attach to a congregation, great. And if they, like Deal, get their little group going, because that's the way it has to go. And that's what I almost think really has to happen. I don't mean to be anti-congregational. I mean, I think that's the way maybe the renewal. We've tried so darn many things on the inside, and it still hasn't done that much. I think if it crops up and begins to, maybe there's more of a chance. I wouldn't fight on that at all. I think that many times we're very good at the education of the small. Yeah.
Don't you have to have some kind of base like the start from? Because
right, from a congregation, people get together and go out. You know,
okay.
Like Deal. Oh, sorry, you didn't read the book. Deal says, you know, some people in the congregation or from three or four congregations, like-minded meet Friday nights, and you know every other week, and they begin just talking about the stuff that is of their ministry. And they stay in the congregation, they go on Sundays, they do all the other things. You know, it doesn't have to be a split. I'm not encouraging, you know, espousing that kind of a thing because I have a respect for it. But I think that some other things might have to pop. And they're from them. I think something might happen.
Yeah,
now, maybe it doesn't.
That's personal, because like, I just moved out here and I don't have any church to even begin to, you know, feeling this kind of community type of. You know, I realize you need that base of a church.
But your answer is almost a non-answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's to his question. If it's not structural, if it's not, so you wait till it spontaneously happens.
My direct answer to him was to espouse openness on the part of laity and clergy enough so to let it happen. And that's far. And I said my second was a non-answer because I don't know how to go about that other than. Places like this and people like you and anybody else keep saying it so that in places like Los Angeles and others where we can begin to say, hey, something different is happening and say that it's all right for it to happen outside of that structure.
The thing is, I feel that that's been going on for a long time, and that's where a lot of your good people, or even your bad people, whatever that means, you know, are dropping out or just burning out or whatever. And nothing else forms from that.
I'd like to share that once once we got a group of lay people who were meeting together in a Koinonia group on a regular basis, something very surprising happened. And at least I think it surprised a lot of us. And that was that we found that what we needed more and more, more intensely and more frequently, was the communion of the congregation. That is to say, was the gathering and scattering concept. We found a more frequent need and wish to get together with the larger group in addition to the regular worship services. Mm-hmm. For midweek family picnics, certainly the Lord's Supper became a stronger need. In other words, we found a new role for the church to play, too. That is the gathered church, the nourishing role.
Amen.
And I suppose that was because we were more mindful and aware that our weekday life was indeed a ministry and a witness, and we found a greater need to get back into the family.
Draining.
So though there is a lot of concern, sometimes expressed and sometimes not expressed, on the part of pastors that they'll lose their people if they encourage this sort of thing, in fact, if it's handled well and we realize who our guide is and all this, it's just the opposite.
I guess I'd want to confront pastors, say, yep, that's possible, you might lose your people, and that might not be such a bad idea. I'd want to say that because I think that has to be said. Otherwise, there's an idolatry in the congregation, and we certainly limit that. On the other hand, I believe with you, not only will it be there more desire to gather, but a tougher job and more exciting job for that pastor than he's ever had before. He's not going to get hung going to stupid meetings where somebody asks him to say a prayer. Because he's going to have to face up to the kinds of stuff happening out there and deal with that. Not for answers, but just to struggle through with people who are going through the kinds of things Deal writes about and others. And day by day, I think it's the most exciting vista for parish service and ministry. I think that, we ain't seen nothing yet.
Yeah, except, you know, you going through the seminary, I'm in the seminary, that's not what you're here in the seminary, that's not how you train at all. Also, that brings up problems. What are we going to do with our million-dollar structures that we already have that are doing like, and who pays the pastor how much and why is he paying now?
But that brings up too. I mean, the seminary, I think already people like Bill Deal have at least started discussions happening among the people that are involved in seminary education.
But in your fourth year, the first half of the year, you talked about your internship and how great it was. Nobody really has a bad internship. They always put best instruction on everything. And then the last half is they're talking about their negotiations for certain congregations, where you're going to go. And nobody really, you don't talk loud if you would like to go to a rural congregation. You know, the big goal is to become an assistant or the associate in the big Minneapolis church. I went to Northwestern Luther Seminary. Okay. The big Minneapolis St. Paul congregation would be the third in the city. If you're stuck in the country, it's good for 3 to 5 years, then you can come into the Twin Cities. See what I mean? And, you know, I agree. I haven't read the book, so excuse me on that, but what you were saying about it, and what he says, and, but, yeah, you do hear it, but that thinking is there. I don't know of a church body who prides in the fact that their congregations are shrinking in size. They put a pastor in, they put a congregation of 1,000, in a couple of years, he gets it down to a nice 200 good size. You know, he's not, you know, that doesn't look good on paper.
I think Bill has a couple of good ideas in here. I think, well, your prayer, lifting up those people for prayer, was such a neat idea. Check your church publications, you know. Who's in? It's always pastors. You go to an LCA convention, and I can pick on LCA now because I've been flipping around synodical bodies. My gosh, the first thing they do, you know what they do? Accept pastors as members. then accept congregations as members, and then do necrology. Who died in the church last year? Who? Pastors died.
Nobody died. Pastors.
No, on the outside. What's the message after a while? Well, it's pastors. The church is pastors. The guy up front is a pastor. The speaker who comes on is his crony. I'm speaking of five LCA conventions I, by virtue of my office, had to go to this year. Five of them. The crony from the bishop's seminary days is the speaker, you know, and they're having good old times as in seminary days. I sat there and said to the guy next to me, what is the message to these lay people? If they're dumb, they would still understand, and they aren't, they're bright. They know that message is all about pastors. Yeah.
Well, it's not only that, it's that half the people voting are pastors.
Are pastors right off the bat.
It's just loaded. Hmm? And they're the ones that know what's going on. We have a study session for, you know, a few minutes on an issue.
Sure.
And, you know, it just seems like we should have more courage of the people in that voting group.
I had such strong feelings about that. I wondered why those people in front of me, you know, and I talked to some of them about it. Why don't you just stand up and scream? You know, why don't you do something? You know, I sat there going, bah, bah, bah. I'm just to myself, not to them.
It's Italian.
It's Italian. Yeah.
I've been a member of two Lutheran denominations, and I work for the church, and I'm not a pastor. And that's even in a worse position. Then you don't have a vote any which way. Either as a layperson or as a professional church worker, both in the Missouri Synod or in the LCA, which I'm under now.
Go ahead, Jay Paul.
Part of that gets back to not only within the church, our church, but in just individual churches. That is, again, the way kids learn and stuff is through models. And we're not providing any models, just a simple thing like prayer. Personal prayer is so inappropriate when someone tries to model what they hear the minister doing up in front in a written prayer or one of those things, or when they see someone witnessing up in front of 500 people and then try to use the same kind of thing to their next door neighbor. I mean, those are inappropriate models, and if we're going to have an active laity doing ministry and in the profession, we've got to provide them with models, and they're not there.
Hey, yeah, please.
Maybe a clue to where your own congregation has a really close look at the budget to see where the money's going. I know in our church, we have our church home, and we have for others, which includes benevolence. Mm-hmm. We were, you know, the benevolence, so that portion for others was kind of decreasing. We even stuck our intern in there to make that look better. Yeah. You know, we're doing the church favor there, so we put that in there. But, you know, the items are very small there, you know. We have a couple of things, you know, fish, and we support a couple hundred dollars for a prison group that meets in the Neal Island and so forth. But, it's small compared to the total budget, very small.
And I'll bet the amount that goes into lay education.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any continuing ed, it's going to be to send the pastors to yet another training event.
Okay. You let money, we put aside money. It's hard getting the lay to go. Huh. A lot of stuff's done during the day.
Yeah.
I hear a lot of the scattering here that is not being recognized in the church, but it's still happening.
Always. It's all
so
there.
It's not total. They must have their support somewhere.
Yes, right.
It's my support to him because we're friends or we're in the same church or something.
Right.
We may not be getting it in the organized church, but nevertheless, it's there, so it's not hopeless.
I surely don't believe it's hopeless. I surely agree with you, or I don't think the book, the book would be worthless. Yeah, people aren't doing it. When I said the congregations weren't taking these people seriously, that didn't mean they weren't taking themselves seriously. I had a classic example of a man in upper middle management who was doing a fantastic job. And he told me all about it over lunch, and I said, I kidded him. I think, what did that have to do with God? And he spewed out in gorgeous way. I wish I had a tape to say how this guy saw all of the things he was doing in management of his corporation connected with God and his Lord. And then I smiled again at Hank and I said, well, what's that got to do with our congregation? Very active members of the congregation. Well, nothing, of course. See, he saw no connection. It should have.
Why do we care? You know, if my congregation holds my name up and says, Graham, you're doing a great job wherever you're doing it. I don't have to have that, you know. I mean, I'm pretty confident that professionally I'm doing okay. It really helps a lot to know that support is there. But I think that there are a lot of lay people who would like to see the church survive.
Sure.
And that really the church is a lay. I think that the clergy probably constitutes about 1% of the people of God.
The clergy are also lay.
That's true.
Truth,
anyway.
The thing that, I mean, I guess where I still see the congregation involved is, I mean, he talks about all these, and I use the word skills,
mm-hmm.
okay, and I mean, if you're going to be a competent Christian, all right, I mean, and he gives examples of
yeah.
things, it seems to me that the place to learn that stuff that for a lot of people is with other Christians,
yeah.
and that somehow probably would be a radical idea if that was part of the church.
Yeah. Under each of the kinds of ministry he sees, ministry of ethics, ministry of word, ministry of aid, he lists some skills that he thinks congregations ought to be offering. Two quickie closes. I was in Geneva, Switzerland for a World Council of Churches meeting, talking with a very radical fellow from Africa at that time, well, not from South Africa, a Christian fellow. And we were walking up the hill, I remember very vividly, and he's a Christian. And he said, but he said to me in the heat of the discussion, I want your damn Jesus until you want me. Send your blankety-blank missionary to New York, to the boards of directors of those companies that are screwing us. And then I'll listen to your Jesus. Now, he really knew his Jesus and all that, but he was so angry at the time. And man, that made a deep, deep thing. I think I could find the footprints that I left when I walked with him that day. The other is the thing we just bounced into accidentally out of our own family devotions when we commissioned our kids whenever they went to school. They were our and congregational, you know, representative to that outfit at fifth grade or whether, or somebody went to St. Olaf. God, they need missionaries at St. Olaf like any other place in the world. And we just bounced into that and we did it. And then we got reports from, when we got back, we talked about what it was like and stuff like that. You know, no big deal, but we backed into it. I think that kind of mood, if we can get that out, as you say, they're there already. We don't have to concoct anything. We got to help maybe them to see it, they maybe don't see it, and support them as they do it. I think there's hope. You're invited back tomorrow.